For the great king to pass a winter on the remote frontiers of the West was clearly out of the question. A devastated Athens was no place from which to administer the world. Having graced the expedition against Europe with his royal presence, it was now imperative for him to finish the war before the close of the campaigning season. Only a thumping victory while the weather held would do. How gratifying, then, that the imperial spy chiefs could report to their royal master that the enemy, squabbling and snarling in their camp, were behaving true to form. Already, on the day of the burning of the Acropolis, several crews had stampeded in panic down to their boats and tried to raise their sails ready for flight. That same evening, it was reported, the high command itself had fragmented yet again into rival factions, Peloponnesians against Athenians and their supporters. A contingent of Persian troops was ordered to take the road to the Isthmus. Since the Corniche beyond Megara had been destroyed, and the Isthmus itself solidly fortified, the expedition had little prospect of storming the gates of the Peloponnese, but that was not its mission. Leaving Athens, rounding Mount Aegileus, following the sacred way towards Eleusis, the soldiers marched along the southern reaches of the Attic coast. Their weapons glittered brightly. Their war songs could be heard for miles. Their feet, 30,000 pairs of them, pounded the road. A great cloud of dust, rising in their wake, drifted on the breeze and was borne across the straits towards Salamis, where the reaction was, just as Persian strategists had anticipated that it would be, one of consternation. Mutinous whisperings began to sweep through the Peloponnesian contingents yet again. Then, with afternoon fading into evening, and anxious sailors already besieging their captains with demands to sail for the Isthmus, the great king gave instructions that the screws be tightened further. Squadrons of the imperial fleet, bearing down on Salamis and taking up their stations with a perfect show of leisure, began to patrol directly off the island, menacing the escape routes. As the setting sun blazed its reflection across the sea from Salamis to the Isthmus, many Peloponnesians appeared on the verge of insurrection. For there they were, stranded on Salamis, obliged to fight in defence of Athenian territory, and certain, if they were defeated, to find themselves trapped and blockaded on an island. And all the while, their own country stood defenceless, even as the barbarians, marching through the night, were advancing directly on the Peloponnese. Now, with the whole Greek fleet apparently at daggers drawn, it was time to bait the trap the great king had laid with such cunning. It was almost sunset. The squadrons on patrol off Salamis were ordered back to base. This withdrawal, performed in full view of the Allied lookouts, left the escape route to the Isthmus very obviously and very temptingly open. The Peloponnesians, irrespective of whether the Athenians agreed to sail with them, might very well take their chance and flee the straits. The Greek fleet would then disintegrate. But Xerxes, weighing the odds that evening, still had to know for sure. The ambush could be attempted only once. It was not enough merely to foster division. Active treachery was needed, too. The ideal would be a double agent within the ranks of the Greek high command. Fortunate, then, that the Persian intelligence chiefs had long and fruitful experience of recruiting top-level moles. "The man who cooperates with me, on him will I bestow rich rewards." This, baldly stated, had always been the manifesto of the Persian monarchy. What rewards, then, for the man who had it within his power to betray the whole Greek fleet and win the war and the West itself for the great king?